I'm thrilled to be here, thrilled to be with you, and very happy to hear two of the greatest speakers about poetry I've heard since my second grade teacher, which is really saying a lot, because I've heard a lot of speakers about poetry, but I feel so overly stimulated, as Edward Hirsch used to say, by everything we heard this morning, by the encouraging words, by the insights, the expertise of Betty Sue Flowers and Coleman Hutchinson, whom I'm very, very honored to meet. Thank you, Mike Gillette and Eric Lupfer, for putting this together, and all the great staff here at Humanities Texas. It's such an honor to be in this beautiful room. I've only been in it with the book tables before, so to meet you all and think about all the lives you touch is very, very precious. And I took so many notes this morning that it reminded me of life and how we become these people we are and how we find our paths as educators, as writers. 42 years ago, when I went just a few blocks from here to the Texas Commission on the Arts to talk to them about the Poets in Schools program, that was just then a fledgling program in the state of Texas and in many other states as well. There was only one person I knew of, whom I'd just been knowing for a few years already, Rosemary Katakalos, who was working in schools in San Antonio in a way that seemed incredibly important to me and admirable, and I was curious about it. I wasn't confident at all about doing it, but I knew she was someone I wanted to watch and I wanted to follow, and today, lucky you get to be with her this afternoon. I thank Rose for coming. She has been a mentor to me as a poet, as a human being, as an organizer of so many incredible projects for educators and kids and community all these years, and so I feel really lucky that I had a conflict where I have to go home at lunchtime because you get to be with her, the person who preceded me in this work in Texas, working in so many schools. So thank you, Rose, for being here. You will always have the voice we cherish. I've used her poems in classrooms so many times that whole sections of them I can say by heart, and I was very touched when Cole talked about when a plane is bumpy and you start quoting a poem in your mind. I often quote Rose's, and so just to be here and hear him say that was... it's like a big full circle. So I was such a naive person when I went over to the Texas Commission on the Arts 42 years ago, and they said, so what are your credentials to be a poet in the schools? And I said, well, I started writing poems when I was 6, and I had a really great teacher when I was 7, Harriet Barron Lane. I lived in Ferguson, Missouri, a town no one had ever heard of if you did not live in St. Louis County. And Harriet Lane, who was the legendary oldest teacher in the entire St. Louis County of schools, was passionate about poetry, believed it was at the center of the universe, and if you lived with it on a daily basis, it would change everything for you, change your metaphor, give you friends, give you emotional intelligence, and all the things we've heard about. To this day, I have no idea if she wrote a lot of poems herself. None of us ever asked her that. You know, when you're 7 years old, you don't always ask your teacher, are you writing at home? What did you write recently? We were just doing everything she told us to do. I did have a chance to thank her when she was 98 for having confirmed my life path for me in second grade. And she loved all the poets who've been discussed today, especially Whitman, Dickinson, and Hughes were her three favorites if she had been asked to choose. But she also loved people like Rabindranath Tagore, Robert Louis Stevenson, Christina Rossetti, Carl Sandburg, William Blake, many people who might have been thought by other teachers to be above the heads of seven-year-olds. I mean, William Blake. I took a college course in William Blake, but I haven't met many teachers in second grade classrooms who share William Blake regularly. She, however, believed nothing was above us, that we could rise to a poem instead of having to kind of explain the poem to us. Let us rise to the poem. Let our vocabulary studies come from the poems. Let our science discussions come from the poems. She did believe in regular recitation and memorization, as Cole said he does. She did believe in making handmade books, which we would stitch regularly through the year. And she did believe that it was okay to put a poem by Joe, who sat next to you, next to Emily Dickinson's poem in your own book. We were each anthologists of our own books. And that would be a reasonable thing to do if it was one of your favorite poems. She honored us by respecting our own taste. Never would I imagine that I would make anthologies later in my life, but I certainly believed in the ones we made when we were 7. So I told something about this woman to the Texas Commission on the Arts, and I said I'd been working in a summer camp for high school age writers, and those were my credentials. I hadn't brought a vita, I hadn't brought any poems. I mean, the ways we applied for jobs in those days seems miraculous that anything ever happened at all. But they said, okay, we'll send you out. In fact, could you just travel all the time in Texas? Just not go home and just travel all the time. I said, sure, I can do that. And they said, but you'll have to live out of your car. And okay, fine. We pay no expenses in those days. No hotel, motel. But you will have a choice. You could stay at a teacher's home or someone's home in these towns you'll be going to. I was young and reckless. I said, sure, I'll stay in anyone's home. Definitely, my life in Texas changed forever after, making all these friends in places like Comstock, Albany, Longview, Marshall, all these little towns where I stayed in homes. They said, you'll have to turn in a report every month about what's been going on. And you know, there were very few guidelines, but there were some guidelines. And I thought, this just seems like the greatest job in the world. They said, how long do you think you'd like to do this? I said, 2 years. So 42 years later, I'm here, a few blocks from their office, and it makes me feel very happy about all of the classrooms I have had a privilege to be in, and you are truly my heroes in the world. You know, every time on an airplane when we're asked to clap for someone in the military, I say, what about the teachers? I bet we have some teachers on this plane. You are the ones who have to have energy every day to go see so many faces, so many lives, so many hearts. What could writers in the schools or artists in the schools possibly have to contribute to offer to people like you who already had found resources and so much energy to do what you do on a regular basis? What did we have to offer? So from the beginning, I had to figure out, okay, I'm going to have so many 50-minute periods with students of all ages, rural, urban. Some of the teachers would be passionate about poetry. Most of them would not be. But they were willing to let a stranger come in and take over their class for whatever finite period of time. Sometimes it would be, you know, 6 weeks in Temple, Texas. Sometimes it would be 2 weeks in Kingsville. And you're going to all the schools. Sometimes it would be working with a colleague in a district where we both had our own schools and we kept trying to figure out ways to cross over and do projects that would involve more of the community. But coming up with strategies that would enable kids to find their own life with poetry or sense of poetry quickly and also be able to connect to what was already going on in that classroom. And in some cases, lots of poetry, and in some cases, none at all. I met a man named Robert Grant Burns, who was then living in Austin. I really don't know what happened in his life, but he talked, I mean, later, we didn't stay friends for a long time or anything, but he talked about how he'd been visiting a few high schools in Austin at that time. So this would have been like 1974. A few high schools in Austin to talk about poetry, and he felt that one thing that was not stressed enough was that all of these poems written in the world had to connect to you for them to matter to you. Or that you had to find a doorway, a window, a way, a sofa in that poem. You had to find a place to sit. You had to fall in love with the word glazed. You had to be able to feel that room as your own before you could care about the poem you were reading by someone else, or before you might be inspired to write some of your own poems. So maybe 10 years passed, or more, a little more, 20 years, I guess, I don't know. For a period of time, I was taking a lot of poems by Iraqi writers into classrooms for important reasons, I felt, just to share the rich heritage of Iraqi writing. And the only thing most kids were hearing about Iraq, this is back in the early 90s, was that we were about ready to go bomb there. And someone said to me, well, they're not going to like that. Teachers aren't going to like that if you show up with poems from the same countries in the news and you don't talk a lot about peace work or activism. You just share a poem and say, this person lives in Baghdad. On the contrary, the teachers loved it. The teachers were smart. They said, where did you get those poems? Give us more of those poems. Who's translating them? How do we connect to those people? And it was teachers in Dallas who first pushed me, urged me, nagged me to make the book that you're being given today called This Same Sky, a collection of poems from around the world. And on the back, an Iraqi poem by Zuhur Dixon. Overture, who can open the door of the green river of the golden clouds of my heart? Was very carefully selected for the time in history in which this book was made. I had a secret dream for this book. These were the kinds of poems I was using and sharing in classrooms. But I wanted the book to be one that didn't have a particular readership age attached to it, where you could be in fifth grade and understand a lot of the poems, or in high school or college, and still feel the poems weren't talking down to you. My publisher didn't really like that. They said, we're not used to making books that are for fifth graders through 100-year-olds. And I said, but why not? Do we even have to put that on here? I don't think they did. But the book is still in print, and it has survived much classroom usage. And I just wanted to read you one of the first poems I received, and another mentor in my life, William Stafford, great American poet, had told me he really liked this poet, Miroslav Holub, from what used to be called Czechoslovakia. This poem is translated by Kaka Polakova. I ended up getting into a long correspondence with Miroslav, who was also a scientist working with immunity. And he said that being a poet made him a much better scientist, and vice versa. And he said, I can't decide among these five translations I'm sending you. I don't speak English that well. You pick the one you like the best. So this is one that is in the book. Napoleon, it's on page 151. And over the years, I know teachers have told me, students often talk about this poem as just an exchange they know well, the classroom atmosphere. Children, when was Napoleon Bonaparte born? Asks the teacher. 1,000 years ago? Say the children. 100 years ago? Say the children. Nobody knows. Children, what did Napoleon Bonaparte do? Asks the teacher. He won a war, says the children. He lost a war, says the children. Nobody knows. Our butcher used to have a dog, says Frankie, and his name was Napoleon, and the butcher used to beat him, and the dog died of hunger a year ago. And now all the children feel sorry for Napoleon. Poems that bring us into our own lives, that help us see where we are, that have some connection. Well, why would a dog even have been named that by a butcher? All the conversations you could have around a poem that simple, that's a conversational scene. I started collecting poems like that, that could be used with students, developing a strategy. I started thinking about how to help them care about the material of their own lives, how to engage with it as material. You know, if you ask students, or if you say, all of us have characters in our lives, tell me about some of your characters, they may go blank. But if you say, do any of you have a weird neighbor? Do any of you have a relative you wish you could change? Has there ever been anyone you know who disapproved of you, and you heard about it, and it really stung, but you didn't want to let them know you knew. Just bringing the questions into the classroom space. Every single hand goes up. Do any of you have anyone in your family who doesn't talk to someone else in your family? Surprisingly, that was probably the question that got the most poems going over the years when you're talking about characters and family members. Disconnection leading to, well, what connection could I make? What understanding could I have? How to immerse, extend, believe in our lives a little more. A poet I admire very much, who grew up in what used to be called Yugoslavia, Charles Simic, has said the worst thing we can do is paraphrase a poem in duller language. And that's what we do all the time when we ask the question, what do you mean? So I loved how Betty Sue said she doesn't ask that question, what do you mean? You think of it more as a mystery to play with. Ask how it works. I often have asked them, is there anything in this poem you like? You know, when sharing a poem. Any phrase, any word you like. Is there anything, even just a little line that reminds you of something in your own life? Is there anything in it that seems completely mysterious to you? And over the years, I think it's been very helpful to present poems that I, myself, didn't fully understand, where there was a line or a phrase that confounded me. Because I could say, honestly, I don't quite know about those lines. Anybody have any ideas? And then the conversation would feel stronger. Just a couple of years ago, I was with librarians in Wisconsin, and we had a little section about poetry writing in libraries and so forth after school. And one librarian said, so what have you done over all these years when kids have made fun of one another? Made fun of one another's work. And then I was really confounded, and I had to think a long time and say, it has never happened. I have never seen a kid, even in the toughest, roughest schools you could imagine, make fun of another kid's work when that work was presented with genuine affection, authenticity, honor. I guess I've been visiting schools about 10 years when a high school creative writing teacher, designated as such, doesn't always exist in high schools, then or now, called me to her at lunch and said, I needed to visit my class right after lunch. I saw you have a free period. And these students are really losers. I don't know what's happened to them. The last 5 years, I was getting all these great poems out of them and no good anymore. So I'd like you just to sit in the corner, be invisible, and tell me what's wrong with them. And this is what happened. I went to her class. I sat in the corner. She stood up. She said, good morning, everybody. Get out your papers. Today, I would like everyone to write about the sunset and use the image of a grapefruit at least twice. And she sat down at her desk. We'd been in there 2 minutes, 1 minute. I walked straight up to her desk. They were all looking around like... I walked up to her desk. I said, could I see you outside? I already know. Okay. This is the strategy that I think helps the classroom writing experience. I tried to suggest it to her that day and talk about it with her. And over the years, it kind of became a little clearer to me. What are we really doing? And I think you can do this if you have 50 minutes. You can also amazingly do it if you have 15 minutes. And you can do it with any age. You can do it with adults. You can do it with parents. You can do it any place. But this is the little list of the things that I think are helpful to happen. In whatever way you interpret this list or embellish it, suggest your topic idea. She didn't tell us why the sunset. Why was she even thinking about a sunset? Had we had a particularly beautiful one the day before? Make it a little expansive. Why not a sunrise? You know, give it a little space right away. Well, I've been thinking about this thing. This has been in my mind. Put it out there, your topic and a few reasons why. Why it's important to you, why you're selecting it. at that moment. And let them give some insights as well into, you know, what comes to their mind quickly just when you suggest the topic. Number two, have some example poems ready. Usually three. If you do just one or two, they tend to emulate too closely. But three poems, you don't have to use all of the poems. You don't have to use parts of the poems that you don't like. You could just use, especially if you're reading out loud. See, I've never had a PowerPoint experience. I only have pencils made into flowers. But if you read out, you can read and kind of edit the poem for your uses at the moment. I think it's helpful to use a poem by a beloved poet whose name everyone would recognize, like a Dickinson, a Whitman, someone. It's good to use someone local if you have that at your fingertips. It's good to use other student poems. As you go along, you have more of those. But have like whole files and troves of these poems you can pull on. In my case, it's always been very important to use writers from elsewhere, other countries. I think living in Texas, we should always use writers from Mexico in our classrooms. It just seems obvious. But voices that you cherish, you've selected these poems for the particular topic of the day. Talk about those poems briefly. Ask maybe a few questions, you know, after you read sections of them. Anybody like anything in this poem? What caught your ear? What image do you see after this poem? Just very briefly, but have the conversation alive in the air. That's always seemed extremely important in a classroom writing experience, that you hear people's voices talking first and not just yours. Where does this poem take you? What lines or phrases do you like best? Then a little warm-up time, if you have time. On the board, on these pads that they have now instead of boards, I guess you could do it on the things where you write and it gets big now. If you are talking about grandfathers, for example, just it could be lists of nouns and verbs that you think of when you think of a particular grandfather. It doesn't have to be your own. It could be the one who lives next door and you just see him a lot. Feel free, as an instructor, to cross out or add to things that are put on the board. I've always thought that it's very important for them to see us revise, even as we're writing down notes, because it suggests that it's not all formulated and in a straight, clear order immediately for us. Get that talk rolling. The talk, the questions you ask about the poems or about the topic. Hear some lines. If someone says an amazing line, quickly write the whole line. And that could take 4 minutes, the whole thing, 5 minutes. But hearing the voices. And then the quiet writing time. 7 minutes seems to be a magical amount of time that we often have. It doesn't sound like much, but it often seemed that that was what you end up with. 7 minutes, 10 minutes, whatever you have. Of course, if you have more, it could be better. But sometimes having the compressed 7 minutes could be very useful. And then the sharing time. Not everyone has to share. A few people will want to share, and you can make some suggestions. Always a possibility of anonymous sharing, where you could trade with someone, and they read yours, you read theirs, or they could give it to you in a little stack, and you read some of theirs. And then the final suggestions of the session, like where you might take this, how you might work on it further, how you might develop it, a further writing idea. Ask them for further writing ideas they came up with while writing that piece. You know, in some cases, depending on the situation, like if it's your regular classroom and you're working with them, you can actually collect things and look at them. But sometimes you don't want to collect everything. Sometimes you want to leave it in their notebook, leave it on their desk, so they have time to revise it and work with it later, and then giving them some suggestion for writing to do before you see them again. And so as it goes on, then it, you know, keeps gathering power and gathering pages, because when they first come into class, before your suggestion of the new topic, you may want to invite who wants to read from what we started on or talked about the last time. Any questions about that simple strategy? It's very fluid, very fluent, probably very obvious, but I think the talking part is really crucial before the writing part. And they will become more and more comfortable with it. And I loved Betty Sue dwelling with the poem. That is such a great phrase, because as they do their own writing, it's as if they're dwelling with the poems that were examples, and maybe even speaking back to them, answering them. I have met many teachers who conduct writing workshop sessions who say they don't use example poems, but I really feel we need them. We need them to kind of prime the pump. We need that wellspring. And having poems that are very, very different in their style of diction and lineage and how they're presented, long-line poems, short-line poems, to mix it up, to give them three different ones at the beginning, most helpful. So this is the process that seems to help it become a regular habit. Once they feel this, oh, so we did this together. I could do this alone. I could ask myself the questions. I could hover over the lines and phrases in a poem and see what holds me the most. I think something opens up between themselves and that blank page. You know, I kept thinking about the grapefruit students. A lot of kids don't like grapefruit. They don't eat it. Or they think of it as, something. The idea of having your metaphor given to you seemed particularly grievous somehow. Not even an orange involved. But having it be open and yet very prescribed, as in this strategy, seems helpful. Because really it's quite open-ended. But it's also prescribed. There's a process that you go through yourself. Never have I had students suggest that this was impossible for very long. Now, sometimes students will suggest that their own writing is particularly impossible on any given day. And you may need to have at the ready the helpful quotes, like the Galway Canal quote. To me, poetry is someone standing up, so to speak, and saying, with as little concealment as possible, what it is for him or her to be on earth at this moment. So even if it feels impossible, there's your place to begin. Even if you feel wounded, there's your place to begin. Allowing them to see that you don't have to be in a frolicking, cheerful mood in order to begin. And probably they'll already know this because they've already discovered the, at least if they're in high school, the power of depression for focus and intensity. So the years went by, and one year rolled into another, and always there were expansions and ways things changed. I was asked at some point in the 80s by someone, this surprised me, my own high school health teacher, who by this time had started a therapy center for adults who were not hospitalized with various diagnoses, but were out in the world, but still wanting to come to classes, to come work in poetry therapy. I had no training, official training in it, but it seemed that it wouldn't be that different from working in classrooms and working with one's own page. So worked in a project with adults for 2 years. I'm still friends with some of them and still encouraging some of them to write. This is like 25 years ago. And saw their hunger to be read to, possibly more than student hunger to be read to, because once they were adults, no one read to them. They didn't have a text. No one gave them an assignment. You need to know this by tomorrow. So always there were little changes, like maybe reading more, depending on the group you were with. And working in other countries, things that would happen where you'd see, well, you know, maybe that won't work as well here. We'll have to do something else if language skills are less or confidence in English is less. But basically that strategy, traveling everywhere. So here are just a couple of poems I wanted to share with you. Let me see if I... A fourth grader Brenda Burmeister, we're still friends, wrote this. That day we were talking about poems trying to look into things, not just at them, not just at the surface, but more deeply into. And she had a small mirror on her desk, a broken compact. She was the only person with a mirror, which I noted. And I thought, wow, that would have been a good idea, just to find a bunch of broken mirrors or cheap mirrors and bring them in. Looking into something that's near and dear to you at this moment, your given moment. And I noticed her erasing a lot and then going back to it and erasing, going back to it. And when she handed it to me, she said, well, the last line was really, really hard, but I think I found it. Here's her poem. Brenda Burmeister, fourth grade. Alone with my mirror, dreaming of love, wishing for love, thinking of my dear old grandmother. My eyes represent my grandmother. My nose represents my grandmother. Suddenly my face turns into my dear old grandmother. I start to speak. I hear my voice. I hear my grandmother's voice. I say to myself, that can't be my grandmother. She is dead. She says to me, it is your grandmother. I had trust in my grandmother, so I believe my grandmother lives beyond death in my mirror. So the last line was beyond death in my mirror. She would end up being a very avid poet. She would become a filmmaker as an adult. She said that writing in her notebook as a child was what helped her to see that she saw the world in scenes. So if you saw the world in scenes all the time, what could you do with that? Make films, too. Her own high school-age daughter right now is an extremely talented poet in San Antonio. And I've thought so many times about that sense of discovery that she claimed when she handed me the poem, I think I found it. And she admitted in later weeks, you know, if I hadn't started writing that poem, I was really sad that day. I might not have found that idea, that notion. Sometimes we have to enter into this terrain, this mystery terrain, and hope that we'll be taken somewhere that is helpful to us or that helps us connect with whatever we need at that moment. Brenda's poem has continued to speak to me all these years. And this year in China, in the only Chinese-owned boarding school for high school students who hope to go to the United States or Canada or Australia or England, an English-speaking country, for college, this poem was written. Now, I have received many messages from the teachers and librarian at this school saying that they had no confidence in English and they all thought of poetry as something that belonged to antiquity and the great traditions of Chinese poetry, and they were quite well-versed in those. That's fantastic. Tell them to bring in some of those poems they love, and they can translate them for me or share that with me. But that they would not feel comfortable to write in English. Nevertheless, they wanted me to come. And on the very first day, some of the kids walked with me back to the room where I was staying, and they said, do you know that there are cobras all around your room? I wasn't sure if they were just trying to make me leave, or but there were, actually. This was a very high cobra area of China. Anyway, the poems were incredible. This was one of my favorites, and in China, it's very big not only to have your computer with you, your backpack with you, but an amazing pencil case. Everybody has a pencil box, a pencil case, pencil envelope, some sort of pencil carrier. So this was a day we were only going to write about what was in our pencil cases. And many people had photographs in them, or acorns, or cobra food. I don't know what they had there. So Crystal Zhang wrote The Pencil. And she was the most outspoken, reluctant writer before the class began. I don't speak English. I don't understand commas. The Pencil. When my mom was a student, there was a pencil she loved. When I became a student, she gave the pencil to me. She says she can see golden sunshine spilling everywhere every time she holds the pencil. But I think the pencil is daydreaming, dreaming itself into being a wise little bird, pondering all the time, dipping into the pond to kiss water. I wish I had magic so that I could see my mom holding this pencil and smiling like a little girl. And that was the stub of pencil she carried with her everywhere. She didn't use it anymore because she didn't want it to disappear. But she carried it everywhere. It was her talisman of connection. And these kids were at boarding school, so they were far away from their moms and dads. Her class loved that poem. They asked her to read it again. They were intrigued because some of them had seen that little pencil and they had no idea its history, that it had been her mother's pencil. She'd never talked about it before. Shortly after, when I came back home, I was asked to select poems by anyone in the world, they said, to be on hospital trays all over the Republic of Ireland. It's a project in Ireland called Poems for Patients, spelled with a C-E, but given to patients with a T-S. And they make these little menus. They're beautiful. They're blue and they have waves on the edges. And they put different poems, like every day when you get your hospital meal, you get a poem, comes with it. And so they said every year they pick 22 new poems. And so Crystal's poem went onto the Irish hospital trays. Oh, yeah. And she liked that a lot. And she said her mother liked it a lot. And she even rejected, they offered her 100 euros. And she said, no, I just want a picture of the tray in my mind. I don't want any money. I'm a kid. I don't need money. They thought that was very funny. They said, kids need money more than anyone. She said, I'm a kid. I don't need money. So, poems for patients. And why can't we do that in the United States? Yeah, we all have friends in hospitals, going into hospitals, coming out of hospitals. When I've been in the hospital, I would really like a poem to come with my mail. So many ways to hearten one another. And one thing I've noticed is it doesn't take a lot of poems like these to completely change the atmosphere in a room. If the students hear a poem like Crystal's or Brenda's or so many other poems, I'll say one more at the end here from Canada, and they really like it, and they're kind of amazed by it, and that guy they know and see every day wrote it, something is going to change for them about their own relationship with every other text they encounter. It's a great opportunity for us to share things we love with people we like and love and spend a lot of time with. It's a great opportunity to expand the horizon of literary knowing, encouraging them to write their own work by the other poems that they hear along the way. A couple of years ago, I was in a drugstore San Antonio, and some guy came up, and this happens all the time because I've worked so long in those schools and still go back to some of them, and he said, I remember when you used to come to our class and you always put a poem on the board, on the left-hand corner of the board, that you never said a word about. That was so weird to us because you would leave the classroom, the poem would still be sitting there, and you would never have referred to it. And at first we thought, well, she forgot, obviously. She forgot that poem was up there. But then you did it every time, and it was a different poem every time. And he said, well, I copied. See, secretly, in my mind, those poems were an additional example poem connecting to what we were going to do, but not one I was going to read or talk about. Maybe one that was a little more esoteric, or sometimes they were just a poem that meant a lot to me recently, and I felt there was some connection to what they were going to be writing. So I put it up there. He said, I wrote down all those poems in my notebook, word for word. And then I found that notebook when I was an adult, and I understood every single one why you would have put them on the board, because to me they seemed like the poems I could live by. And even though you had never talked about them, we had never said they were important, shared them, you didn't tell us anything about the author, those are the poems that I kept. The poems that were never mentioned. And that made me so happy because I thought, well, if one person copied them down, maybe somebody else liked them too. So we just have a few minutes here. I want to see if you have questions, but I wanted to mention this book, the Jim Ted book. Two great American writers, Ted Kooser, Jim Harrison. You're all getting a copy of this book. Thank you, Humanities Texas, for sharing this book with them. This has been one of my favorite books to use in classrooms over recent years. And the poems are very tiny. This book started out as little poems that Jim Harrison was sending to Ted Kooser when he got out of the hospital after cancer and was at home recovering in his bed for many, many months. Jim Harrison, his close friend, started sending him little poems in envelopes in the mail because he knew Ted was an old-fashioned person who still preferred real mail. And he wrote them on all different kinds of little pieces of paper. And Ted strung them up on a clothesline in his recovery room. And when he felt like it, he started writing little tiny poems back to Jim in response. They aren't about being sick or getting well. They're just tiny observation poems. Maybe that sense of the preciousness of life and our own fragility comes up in some of them. But I hope you'll like them, and I have found them incredibly useful in classrooms in recent years when time is compressed, when you only have time to share a three-line poem. And these they considered whole poems, complete poems. They decided not to put their names on them because they said, we are tired of the cult of personality. As long as the students know or anyone knows that one of us wrote them, that's fine. We don't need them to know who wrote what. Kids love these poems. They're like little modern haiku. Nobody's counting syllables, but most of them have three or four lines. A couple of them have two. And there are a few that would be inappropriate, a little too sexy for classroom usage, but you can enjoy them. And I've found this like one of the most useful books I've carried around in the last 5 years. An architect, David Lake, told me that this, he's moving back to Austin, where he's from, right now. He said, this book completely refreshed my relationship to language in my field, just reading this book. Just language, fresh language. And I hope you'll find it useful in that way. I hope you'll find it fun. Often, when I'm asking kids to write some notes before they, and I'm going to read them a few poems from this book, I will talk about a few little details you noticed within the last 24 hours. A few metaphors, just little clumps of notes, nuggets of notes on their pages. A few metaphors that pop into your mind today about anything. A few questions you could ask. And if you get them to write like three clumps, this is your warm-up writing time, three clumps of things on the page that they weren't intending to connect, they will be shocked after you read them a few example poems. And, you know, these are poems made of little things, like the kinds of little things you've been writing, at how available poetry becomes to them, just connecting some of the elements from the three clumps they've already made. Does that make sense? So in the note-taking, they're writing this little list, this little list, this little list. You could say a little clump of memories that pop into your mind today. It could be anything. But having that the language on the page before they start extracting and pulling lines and putting them together. Before I say the last poem I was going to say, is there anyone with a question? Yes. Right. Well, there's always the peer group, like making the small group at the end, where a few people read within their small group. If you can break it into the smaller ones, or sometimes just treating it as if it is a small group. You know that not everyone will want to share, so you won't have 38 people lining up. But doing the same thing if you had 10 people, or if you had 50 people, it does work. I mean, it even amazingly works when you're only seeing the group once. And it can be like hundreds of people in the library with their little notebooks. And it will still work if you treat that group as you would treat your own smaller group that you would have preferred. But I do think that there's a lot to be said for getting together in the smaller groups if you can just deal with the logistics of it and sharing their work and making comments, asking questions to one another's work. Someone once asked me, so how have you responded to all the terrible poems you've seen? All the horrible poems. You must have seen many more horrible poems than wonderful poems. I said, just ask questions. And don't look at them as horrible. Look at them as the rough drafts that we're always working on. I mean, if you looked at any of our notebooks, there's all kinds of things in there that, you know, wouldn't look very promising. But you could always ask questions to lead them toward revision. I think sometimes it may end up being better if you have, you know, that number, the 38. I think that's really kind of a good number. Does it just seem like too much to deal with?
I'm just imagining like 38 like fidgeting bodies as one person's trying to read a poem. Yeah, I think you're right. You can harness the power of that many students.
Right. And they won't fidget too much because they're interested in each other. What did she write? Anyone else? I love this program going on in Austin now, the Book Crush, where all the kids get together with books they have crushes on, and then they do their own writing. And when I saw that group this summer, it was like 200 people between first grade and 12th grade all at once talking about books they'd loved and writing, and it even worked out with them. So that seemed like a little bit of a stretch, you know, that big of an age bracket, but it worked out well. Anyone else? You're hungry. I'm hungry. Thank you so much for listening to me, but I'm going to close with this poem. So this came in my mailbox once on not a particularly good day from Winnipeg, Manitoba, from Mr. J.D. Linton. He was at Riverside School. He had a cover letter. He said, we've been writing lots of poetry in our class, and I have doubt about my own. But I wanted to send you this because he had liked some of the poems in an anthology I made called Salting the Ocean, poems by young poets. So he'd found an address and sent this to me. So Mr. Linton, at age 7, wrote, Swirling and Twirling. I don't think I am a real artist yet, though I have developed swirling and twirling. Some people say art is the movement of the pencil and the dancing of the brain. But I disagree with that. Of the paint. But I disagree with that. I think art is about the mind and the mind's feelings. There is one thing some are missing out on. It doesn't matter how your art turns out. It's how much it winks at you. And your mind, and your mind's feelings. Well, I remember taking a breath, written in this big blocky handwriting, and writing him back right away and saying, you changed my day. And the answer to your doubts is in your poem. Just reread that poem 400 times. And then a week or two, three later, getting a box from Manitoba. From two other boys, saying, if you like J.D. Linton's poem, read ours. We're much better. And then I wrote back to them. They were incredibly good. I wrote back to them and said, who is your teacher? What is she doing? And she wrote me and said, well, just come up here and I'll show you. So I went up there. And Texans really should go to Manitoba more often because it's just straight up. And incredible classroom. And it was a three grades in one classroom. And she said her complete motto was exposure. You expose them to voices you love and good things will happen. You paper the entire ceiling and all the walls with poems and they'll soak them up because they spend so much time just staring off into space. They'll soak them up. You give them a little stage made out of boxes in the corner of the room where they can have poetry readings and they can invite any other class in the school they want, like at lunchtime or after school. And they'll be proud. You know, just give them this little tiny bit of low-rent exposure. Her name is Lisa Siemens. She'll always remain one of my favorite teachers I've ever met. And she said, well, I said, so how did you come up with this model? Because it really is working with your students. Incredible poets. She said, well, I was an only child. I grew up on a farm way out from the city. And the only thing I had was books. And I thought the whole world was flat and cold and white. And I was so lonely. And those books saved me. And so I decided I would become a teacher and tell those kids the world was not flat and cold and white. And that's what I do. So thank you all for listening to me.